number of people living in poverty in the U.S. is on the rise. Over 150 million Americans are persistently poor or near poor, meaning they live one to two paychecks away from poverty. On today's Your Call, we'll have a conversation about how poverty is affecting our democracy. We'll be joined by longtime economic justice advocate Ethel Long Scott. And then at 10:30, Dr. Cornel West will join us to talk about The Rich and the Rest of Us, a Poverty Manifesto. It's the new book he co-authored with Tavis Smiley. They argue that poverty threatens our very democracy. Do you agree? And what will it take to have a real conversation about poverty in this country? Join us after the news.
BBC News with David Austin. The Dutch Prime Minister Mark Rutte has resigned along with his cabinet, triggering an early general election in the Netherlands. Mr. Rutte's minority coalition government tried to bring in big spending cuts but failed to get crucial backing from the right-wing Freedom Party. Anna Holligan reports from The Hague.
The coalition government lost its majority in parliament after the leader of the populist Freedom Party, Geert Wilders, withdrew his support. He said the proposed cuts would be too painful for the people and refused to accept them. Elections are now expected to be held sometime in the autumn. In the meantime, the Dutch politicians still have to find a way to reduce their budget deficit to 3% GDP, in line with EU targets. The finance minister has been trying to reassure the markets, following fears the failure of the budget talks could harm the country's much-coveted AAA credit rating.
The former Prime Minister of Iceland, who was put on trial accused of negligence over his country's economic collapse 4 years ago, has been cleared of the major charges. Geir Horter was found guilty of failing to inform or consult cabinet colleagues at the time, but was acquitted on three other counts. Iceland's three main banks collapsed during a single week in 2008, with debts that dwarfed the national economy. Here's John McManus.
Geir Horter is the only world leader who's faced any legal proceedings over the global economic crisis which began in 2008. He stood accused of ignoring the recommendations of an official report, which critics said would have safeguarded Iceland's economy. A special court found him guilty of one charge, that's of failing to meet with his ministers to try and head off the crisis, but cleared him on three others. The judge announced he won't face a jail sentence and that his legal costs will be paid by the state.
Reports from Iran say computers running key parts of the country's oil sector have been targeted in a suspected cyber attack. A special committee has been set up to deal with cyber attacks. James Reynolds has more details.
Iranian news agencies say that the cyber attack began on Sunday and targeted Iran's oil ministry and its main crude oil export terminal. One news agency says that the attack took the form of a virus which has been called Viper. Iran's government says that it disconnected its oil ministry and its export terminal in Kharg Island from the internet in order to counter the attack. It denies that any serious damage has been done.
President Obama is introducing new American measures intended to prevent the authorities in Iran and Syria from using sophisticated communications equipment against dissidents. Mr. Obama said the two countries were conducting violent campaigns against their own people, assisted by what he called the malign use of technology. The order freezes the U.S. assets of anyone who's provided Iran or Syria with satellite, internet or phone technology that could be used to track or monitor dissidents. World News from the BBC. The Jordanian Relief Agency says Syrian troops attacked hundreds of refugees trying to flee from Syria into Jordan on Saturday. A spokesman for the agency said dozens of Syrians were taken to hospital after arriving across the border with burns and gunshot wounds. An actor who accidentally hanged himself while playing Judas in a passion play in Brazil has died. The actor, Thiago Klimek, had been in a coma since the performance. Vanessa Busch-Sluter reports.
The accident happened on stage on Good Friday. The 27-year-old actor was playing Judas Iscariot in The Passion of Christ in the town of Itarare. Enacting the scene in the Bible in which Judas commits suicide, the actor climbed on top of a rock, placed a noose around his neck and jumped. Mr. Klimek fainted, but his fellow actors assumed it was part of the act, only realizing he was in serious trouble after 4 minutes. First aiders cut the actor down and rushed him to hospital, where he was diagnosed with cerebral hypoxia, a condition caused by a decrease of oxygen to the brain.
There's been a sharp fall in incidents of piracy off the coast of Somalia. The International Maritime Bureau said 43 attacks were reported between January and March, less than half the number for the same period last year. The agency said the most significant factor was the deployment of private security guards on merchant ships. No vessel with armed guards had been seized. The Bureau reported that piracy off Nigeria had increased. A new survey by the computer security firm Sophos has found India to be the world's top spam-producing nation. The report, which ranks nations by the amount of junk mail routed through their computers, said India had leapt to the top of the spam chart in less than a year, overtaking the United States. The survey estimates that nearly 10% of all junk mail travels through computers in India. And those are the latest stories from BBC News.
Welcome back. I'm Rose Aguilar, and this is Your Call. This Saturday, April 28th at 6 p.m., KALW is presenting public radio host Tavis Smiley and Professor Cornel West in their only Bay Area appearance. They'll be speaking about their new book, The Rich and the Rest of Us, A Poverty Manifesto. The event is taking place at the Paramount Theater in Oakland. It is free, and it's filling up, so be sure to register at KALW.org. KALW is partnering with a number of local organizations that are raising awareness about economic inequality, providing direct services to the poor, and building wealth in poor communities. One of those organizations is the Women's Economic Agenda Project, or WEAP. For the past three decades, WEAP has been working for economic human rights for poor women and their families. They work to change societal and governmental policies that relegate women to the bottom of the economic pyramid by raising the role and visibility of poor and working people in crafting real solutions to economic injustices. In fact, in 2010, women who worked full-time year-round still only earned 77% of what men earned. The median earnings for women were almost $37,000 a year compared to $47,000 a year for men. Today, we are spending the hour talking about how poverty is affecting the U.S. and democracy. 150 million people either live in poverty or are living one or two paychecks away from poverty. And joining us to talk about this is Ethel Long Scott. She's executive director of the Women's Economic Agenda Project. And Ethel joins us from Oakland. Hi, Ethel. Welcome back to the show.
Good morning, and thanks for having me.
It's great to have you. And I want to mention that we'll be joined by Cornel West at 10:30. And Ethel, Cornel West and Tavis Smiley are on a nationwide tour. They visited something like 17 states talking about poverty. And their main argument is that poverty is really threatening our very democracy. What are your thoughts about that argument? Do you agree?
I couldn't agree more. I think it's so important, the tour that they did, because it helped to highlight a growing shame in our country. The attacks on democracy are sometimes more subtle, but you know, you can really see it when you consider that the phenomenal Occupy Wall Street movements were in many ways gutted because of ferocious anti-poverty laws that had already been established against sitting or squatting, just people existing without the bare essentials to live with. And people came right up against those. Those were the most open ones. But there's also other subtleties, like the ferocious attacks on welfare that are going on state by state by state, where we're cutting by half. It's really austerity measures against poor women and poor families. And we know that these families languish in poverty, and we pretend that cutting their income by half and more is not going to end them on the streets, or we're certainly going to ignore that. No, this is really the attacks on democracy are very tied up. And then, of course, when you look at situations like Wisconsin and Michigan, where trade unions have been destroyed and or whole elected entities are being replaced by either corporate, by private entities that, say, the governor can appoint to replace a city council, to replace a school board, those types of things.
You know, Ethel, it's shocking when you look at these numbers. 150 million people either live in poverty or are living just one to two paychecks away from poverty. When I first cited that number, some friends said that that can't be right. You've got to check that fact. But it is right. 150 million Americans.
This is so amazing. And ask us, Is that the discussion of either of the major parties that are clamoring for the president? This is half of our population, and it really has to do with the broader, deeper structural reorganization that is going on in society, where we have moved from an industrial production base, labor base, to a technology-driven base. Everybody in the super elite are discussing and adjusting for that, but we the people, we are on the back end of that. We experience it with cuts in our schools and cuts in the jobs here in Oakland and across the country. There are fewer people that will be in the paid workforce, and we do not have a reciprocal social contract to meet that. That is the urgent need of the day.
And we've got 45 million Americans living on food stamps. So many children are homeless. You've got families now living in motels. Buses actually have to go to motels to take kids to school. How is this really affecting the United States?
Well, I mean, I think it's the quote-unquote dirty little secret, and it's one of the reasons why we think it's so important. It's so scattered when you think of 150, half of our population that is either in poverty and or careening into it. Let's talk about a number of things in the social contract that is essentially being deconstructed. In the beginning of last century, we essentially began to develop this, that you would have health care, for instance, that was connected with a job. Now, that happened through many battles. No industrialist granted it to us. But that has been unhinged. And so we're finding that families who once had a certain comfort level, when they lose that job, they lose the health care connected to it. And that, it's not only that it's one paycheck away from a crisis, but it's one health crisis away. So you can come through the door of poverty any number of tracks, and that's the reality. So when you see these the safety net being destroyed, I can't tell you how many families that I work with who think that there are programs there or think that there's support there that was, it was horrible 10 years ago, but it's even worse now. And from food stamps to health care, I mean, it's a really crying and it's a criminal situation. And I think that it's a crisis on such a level that frequently we're kind of isolated. Oh, it's just the immigrants. Oh, it's just these women on welfare. But really, it's every person. You can put anybody's face in that spot. And I think that's what we need to make more apparent.
And speaking of making things more apparent, you are organizing 4 days of public hearings from May 10th through May 13th, featuring in-person and on-video testimony from women and their families who have been hurt by poverty-related violence and deprivation. And talk about the importance of really seeing what this looks like, because we really don't see what this looks like, especially if you watch the Sunday shows or you watch the cable shows. You know, it's rare to even see an activist, let alone someone who's living in poverty.
Well, it's rare to see a labor person. It's rare to see anybody who might be talking about what the realities are that we're facing with trying to pay rent or put or trying to put food on the table or keep your children educated under really dire and difficult circumstances. First of all, you know, these World Courts of Women come out of regions of the globe which have already experienced kind of the worst aspects of capitalism. There have been 37 other courts in continents throughout the world. This is the first one in the Western, in the United States, we're hosting for the Western region. We are really excited about this because we think that it provides an opportunity to destigmatize the notion of poverty in America.
Yeah.
And oftentimes, even on a global level, people accept that in the, quote, developing world, there is great poverty, but here in these United States, it's usually lied about. So one, we want to make sure that we have an opportunity to document the plight of our people, but we're also pushing ourselves to do something more, which is based on these phenomenal changes that are going on in the economy. Essentially, it's been an economic revolution that is following a social revolution. We know we have to put forward solutions that would be about healing our people and healing our planet. And where better and working class women to advance those types of visionary solutions. It'll be in Laney College, our community college here in Oakland, and we have a sliding scale. You can come for one day for $25 or all 4 days for $75, and there's an even lower sliding scale for folks who may not have any means. All of that's right on our website, and we really hope that people will come and participate in this discourse, in both the documentation and the discourse.
And so the goal of having these hearings is to give women a voice and to have them in dialogue with members of the community.
Well, it is. Let me just make sure that it's women, men, and families whose voices are silenced. Oftentimes, because we are a women's organization, some assume that that means that we're excluding people. Of course, that's for working class families. We don't have that luxury, and that's not part of our vision. We spend a great deal of our time talking about how do we heal the overall community. So yes, it is about highlighting all of those injustices and highlighting solutions.
Right.
If I might give two, in the city of Oakland, we have some real jewels, but some of our students and teachers at Unity High School, for instance, developed an initiative to do something that is really novel: fund free public education from K through 12 and up through college. Imagine that. But the initiative came out of our schools. Another national example is something that's called the debt swap. In our city, like yours and all across the country, we know that these Wall Street firms have loans to our city. Goldman Sachs, for instance, we gave them our money, nationalized it, and then they turn around, they get forgiven the loan or it gets reduced, and that reduction has not been passed on to the city of Oakland. This would save jobs. This would save resources. And so one of the things we're challenging ourselves, Rose, to do is to deliberate solutions and resolutions of actions that would impact the many millions of us, not only the ones and twos.
And Ethel, when this controversy between Hillary Rosen and Ann Romney broke out, I immediately thought about you because you've been working on these issues for decades. Unfortunately, we talked about this on Friday, but this got so much media attention. The basic facts, like 20 million children living in poverty, and just what women actually do go through, it was really hard to find those facts. So what was your reaction after this conversation exploded?
Well, first of all, I wish we had so many more responsible journalists like yourself who actually spend the time looking at what the realities are as opposed to getting distracted with the flavor of the day and month. Because, of course, if you can focus on the issues of, okay, a diss to one grouping of very elite women who do not work and pretend that that's a reality for a mom who's trying to piece together two or three jobs, maybe not having health care in any of those jobs, and trying to make sure that her kids are safe, even though there's no one if she's a single head of household, because we know that that part of the population is amongst the poorest in our country. Those realities it was an opportunity, but what cowardice that instead we talk about this minute grouping and pretend that that represents the status of the majority of women. It is so important. You know, Dr. King, some 40-some-odd years ago, talked about the need for us to challenge this complacent nation. Mm-hmm. And that's what America's in, like, we've been in a slumber for, I would say, 60 years, because I think that's what Dr. King was speaking to. And we're beginning to awaken. And I think that these conversations around the Rosen Romney are so disingenuous to what the reality that we face.
We're speaking with Ethel Long Scott, Executive Director of the Women's Economic Agenda Project. And again, they are holding 4 days of public hearings, May 10th through the 13th, featuring in-person and on-video testimony from women and their families who've been hurt by poverty-related violence and deprivation. And at 10:30, we'll be joined by Dr. Cornell West. He'll be here on Saturday with Tavis Smiley talking about their new book, The Rich and the Rest of Us, A Poverty Manifesto. You can find information about that event. In fact, seats are filling up. It is a free event, but you should register soon if you're planning to come. You can find information, kalw.org. And Ethel, are you coming on Saturday?
Oh, are you kidding?
Great.
Yes, we are coming, and we're bringing a crew. But we think this is so important, the work that Dr. West and Tavis Smiley have been doing to bring attention to this. But isn't it interesting that our government, few, you can count them almost one hand, those policy persons who are elected to represent us cannot find it within their means to do anything more than put forward this market scheme or that market scheme, yet another proposal. You look at something as innovative as the millionaire's tax, which, you know, not only goes after the millionaires, but it begins to say, look, Wall Street can and should pay for these things. Mm. But it is going to take a broad transformative movement. And I mean transforming the economy, because these technological tools we're talking about could be applied to helping provide work in our community that could take care of people. But that's going to come from the bottom. These people are so bought off, they're not about to put forward solutions that are going to rock the status quo.
Well, and so that's the big question. Ethel Long Scott says, we've been sleeping for 60 years. We're starting to wake up. So what will it take to really wake up and tackle these issues? And what are your thoughts about this argument that poverty really does threaten democracy in the United States? Do you agree with that? What does that mean to you?
I
just wanted to give out the number real quick, Ethel. It's 866-798-8255, 866-798-8255. You can also leave a comment at yourcallradio.org so others can read it, or you can email feedback@yourcallradio.org. And speaking of that, we got an email from John Ethel, and he says, it's great that you're addressing the problems of poverty and inequality in America, but until the subject gets extensive coverage and attention by the major media, forget it. Funny how they never seem to talk about the poor.
They talk about this poor, but they talk about it in ways that are disparaging and in ways that actually destroy our democracy. I think that writer and that person is thinking along precisely these lines. I'd like to speak for a few moments to unpack that a bit in terms of the attacks on democracy that I think are so crucial. This has been underway for quite a while, and I want to really zero in on what I understand this process to be. And a part of that process is it's not only that the poor are getting poorer, but that we are seeing the growing development and encroachment of rights by the absolute power of these corporations over our government. And that part, people, we sometimes say it, and people think that we're kind of, well, it's a bit of hyperbole. But no, I think that if you examine how many of us would have projected exactly what went down, or in a general way, what went down with Wisconsin, where they not only had a legislative battle, but the battle that it was then used, sponsored by the billionaires in this country, to dismantle the whole labor union structure of public sector, with the right of workers to be in organized labor, and then to see that advancement in Michigan, where we have seen some of the worst cuts to welfare, and frequently workers who have jobs and have unions think, well, that's just that section. But these things are very interconnected. The so-called welfare as we know it was really Mr. Gingrich and Mr. Clinton really moving to allow these major corporations to run that program and really to run them out of existence so that more of the workforce would have fewer and fewer opportunities. So I think that it's twofold. It's we see the category of the absolute impoverishment that is resulting from the growing jobless, the structural joblessness. And then the other part is the actual enthronement, really, of these corporations. And that is hard to get our brains around, but it is a real danger. And you can say and do almost anything you want. If you say poor people in the beginning of it, then people are willing to give up all kind of rights. And that is what is happening in America.
Well, we've got a number of callers on the line, so let's hear from Joanne in San Francisco. Hi, Joanne. Welcome to the show.
Hi. Thanks a lot. Love your show.
Thank you.
This is so serendipitous. About just before the show, about half an hour ago, I was on the phone to Medicare trying to get the Part D, which is supposed to cover your drug prescription, for a friend of mine who's over 65, whose doctor just told her she had to take high blood pressure and some other medication. She went to fill it, and it was like $400. She can't afford it. And there was so many, apparently, because, you know, she has to work part-time as well to meet her, as you know, like rent in San Francisco. I think her Social Security is like $700 a month. She works as well to cover her rent and bills. She's worked all her life, but because she makes over $900 and her rent is more than that, she can't get the Part D until the open enrollment in October. I said, well, what's someone's supposed to do if their doctor tells them they have to take their medication now? It's just, there's like no coverage. And it's just, and there's a million things like this. There's just so many things like, anyway, it just happened this morning, and I was like an hour on the phone trying to find, and this woman worked all her life. She, you know, paid into everything for, you know, whatever it was, 50 years, and it's just crazy.
And so what's she going to do?
I don't know. I kept saying this to these different people. I said, well, how are you supposed to buy, get the medicine? And, I mean, it wasn't the people who were, you know, at Social at Medicare and Medi-Cal. They said, there is something. I mean, you have to wait until open enrollment. And then when they told me the limit that you have to be at, I said, well, that's crazy, $900. Do you know what rent alone in San Francisco is? So if someone's only getting $750 on their Social Security, obviously they have to also work just to make their rent and bills. In other words, if their rent is whatever it is, you know, $1,200, I don't know exactly, and their bills are $100 and they have $100 left over for food a month, where's the $800 for their medication going to come from? It's just, it's crazy. I don't know what she's going to do. She can't get it.
Well, what oftentimes, and I'm sure you're aware of this, that means that they're going to either go without those meds, or they're going to cut in half the medicines that they need. Right. It really puts another. I mean, this is where these hidden numbers are. Even when we say the $150 million, there's another whole section that earn just a few dollars too much that they don't even fall exactly in that category. So they're kind of counted as just
like that's her. What she said is she's not going to take. She said, I guess I won't take the medicine. I don't have the money to get it.
Which we should make sure everybody knows that means her life is at risk. And then there'll be some fool pundit saying, oh, they chose to do that. Excuse me? What have we become that we're kicking old people, disabled people, the most fragile people to the curb so a bunch of billionaires can have another yacht, another set of houses on another island? This is insane.
You know, you brought up something, Ethel. What should the response be to this? Because as you said, it's so pervasive. I just met a guy yesterday who lives in Phoenix, Arizona. He said that's all they do. Well, first of all, that's the only access he has in the media is either religious or right-wing radio. But he said all they do is rip on the poor.
Yep.
It's constant.
I think that, one, we need to make it more apparent. And most people who are in this, poverty has such stigma in this country. In this country, if you are poor, you are considered, you're a deadbeat. People say people making $16,000 a year in their minds, their middle income, because they're trying not to associate with, you know, this growing class of new poor that is being developed in our country. But I think we have a job to educate and to organize based on that education. It's not us that should be the shame. It is the shame of our government that we can figure out how to bail out bankers, but we do not bail out our own working people. And I mean, just the example that she gave, here's a woman that's worked all her life, and that is frequently what happens. And then in the latter years, because of any set of circumstances, she's grappling instead of us having a society that is supporting them. But I think the thing is that it raises is it is urgent that we get involved in crafting a new social contract, because the one that I grew up under, that you grew up under, many of your callers, that is being destroyed. And that's what we've got to bring higher attention to. And that's why there's such hatefulness towards working people who are poor.
Well, thank you for calling in, Tracy, and good luck to your friend. And we're joined today by Ethel Long Scott. She's executive director of the Women's Economic Agenda Project, and they are having 4 days of public hearings kicking off May 10th at Laney College in Oakland. You can find more information at yourcallradio.org. And coming up after the break, we'll be joined by Dr. Cornel West. He and Tavis Smiley have written a new book together, The Rich and the Rest of Us, A Poverty Manifesto, and they will be at the Paramount
Vermont on Saturday. KALW is presenting Tavis Smiley and Dr. West. It's a free event, 6 o'clock over in Oakland, and it's filling up fast, so if you'd like to register, now would be a good time to do it. You can find information about registering at kalw.org. And we've teamed up with a number of Bay Area organizations that are working on these very important issues. The Women's Economic Agenda Project will be there along with Ethel Long Scott. And you can join us at 866-798-8255, 866-798-8255, yourcallradio.org. We'll be back after this.
It's easier than ever to listen to local public radio online. You can find KALW's MP3 stream on iTunes, and if you have an iPhone, you can also find us on the new Public Radio Tuner. It's all free, and the details are at KALW.org.
This is Your Call. I'm Rose Aguilar. You can find more information about our show at yourcallradio.org. You can also listen to past shows there and sign up for our newsletter to find out what's coming up. Tomorrow, we'll have a conversation about how city workers are organizing to get contracts with living wages and health care. Last week, over 1,000 San Francisco workers took to the streets to raise awareness about their negotiations, and these include wage cuts and higher health care premiums. A number of people were arrested for blocking traffic. So we'd love to hear from you tomorrow. If you're a city employee, how are budget cuts affecting you? Today, we are talking about the huge number of people living in poverty in this country. It's really hard to believe this, but over 150 million Americans are persistently poor or near poor. And this means that they're living one or two paychecks away from poverty. So today, we are talking about what does this mean for the United States? How does this threaten our democracy? How should we respond to the constant attacks we hear against the poor? And we'd love to hear from you. 866-798-8255. You can also leave a comment, yourcallradio.org. And again, I would like to thank Ethel Long Scott, Executive Director of the Women's Economic Agenda Project, for joining us. She will be at our event this Saturday at 6 o'clock. We are presenting public radio host Tavis Smiley and Dr. Cornel West, their only Bay Area parents. They'll be speaking about their new book, The Rich and the Rest of Us, A Poverty Manifesto. And now I would like to welcome Dr. West to the show. Dr. West is author of a number of books, including the contemporary classic Race Matters, which changed the course of our dialogue on race and injustice. And Dr. West will return this fall as professor of philosophy and Christian practice at Union Theological Seminary in New York City. Hi, Dr. West. Welcome back to the show.
Pleasure to be in dialogue with you. How are you doing today, Sister Rose?
Good. I'm good. Thank you so much for joining us. So Dr. West, one of the main arguments you've been making on this poverty tour with Tavis Smiley is that poverty is really threatening our very democracy. Talk a little bit about that. What do you mean exactly?
I mean that actually when you think of the precious and priceless poor people who are living lives now of social misery, even though they have strong spirits for the most part, that it is a matter of national security. It's more than an external threat. It is an internal rot in America, and America cannot survive with a level of wealth inequality. 1% of the population owns 42% of the wealth. The top 400 individuals have wealth equivalent to the bottom 150 million. So the Occupy movement actually is right on the mark in this regard. And so we're simply saying that there's a state of emergency. We need to have a sense of urgency when you look at the level unemployment and underemployment, the dilapidated housing, this disgraceful school systems, the vicious attacks on trade unions and working people with cutbacks but able to find money for drones that kill innocent people in addition to terrorists, able to find money for military expansion, able to find money for jails and prisons, and not the basic needs of health care and jobs and housing and food, we're in a state of emergency.
Dr. West, as you said, this is not sustainable. Why do you think the 1%, you know, the people who make the decisions and the politicians, are allowing this to actually get worse?
Well, I think greed is a species of moral blindness. It's a species of short-term obsession, and they don't recognize that in the long term, one always reaps what you sow, that you cannot be obsessed with the short-term profit, short-term gain, short-term profit, short-term gain, and not be concerned about the long-term destiny of your society when you're rendering so many folk invisible. And I'm talking about, we began the poverty tour back in August, of course, on Indian reservations, because we should never forget our precious indigenous brothers and sisters who have been wrestling. But same is true in brown barrios, same is true in Black Hood, same is true in our white brothers and sisters, who many of whom were once middle class, now being pushed into poverty. And the same is true for significant numbers of our Asian brothers and sisters.
Speaking of your tour, Dr. West, before we get to phone calls, you've been traveling around the country, 18 cities, talking about these issues. What have you seen through your travels? What's really affected you the most?
I think probably at the deepest level, it's the resilience. It's the tremendous sense of resistance. The fight back takes a number of different forms. It hasn't been able to be organized and mobilized in the way that it ought, though I think that is coming down the road. But individually, people just refuse to be crushed. They refuse to be pushed off a cliff. They're fighting, and it's a matter of trying to bring together poor people. And this is what, of course, the legacy of Martin King, the legacy of Fannie Lou Hamer, Dorothy Day, Rabbi Abraham Joshua Heschel, all of those folk. 50 years ago, when the last war on poverty, Lyndon Baines Johnson, we had about 24% of people living in poverty, and 10 years went down to 11%. War on poverty made a difference.
What about national media, Dr. West? We just got an email earlier from John who says, it's really great that you're talking about this, but until the subject gets extensive coverage and attention by major media, forget it. And, I mean, you guys have been on the Colbert Report, you've been on the Sunday shows, CBS Face the Nation, you name it, and you've probably been on that outlet. Do you feel like the talking heads and these hosts are asking you the right question? And do you think that they'll take this issue and continue with it?
Well, that's a good question. I mean, it's hard to say. It's rare that you get the right questions asked oftentimes by corporate media because they like to highlight certain aspects of it that don't constitute a threat to the status quo. Anytime you have a deep love for poor people, you constitute a kind of threat to the status quo. Love is always a threat in that sense. But the fact that we have received a certain kind of visibility is very important because, as you know, I mean, you've got Marion Wright Edelman, you've got the Advocates for the Other America out there, you've got California Endowment for Healthy Communities, and so many local activists who have done doing magnificent jobs, you know.
Right.
But it's a matter of trying to get that visibility that reinforces their tremendous fight and witness and work.
You know, bringing that up, you just reminded me of ACORN. I mean, do you think that we have sort of come to terms with what it means since since ACORN has been disabled and how that has really affected poor communities?
Well, no, that's a good question, though, sister. It really is. I mean, you think of the vicious attacks on ACORN, the stereotyping of ACORN. I mean, thank God ACORN's bouncing back, in new forms.
Right.
But you're absolutely right. And we're living in a moment, of course, there's a kind of not just demonizing and criminalizing the poor people, but a demonizing and criminalizing of dissent. I mean, this National Defense Authorization Act is very chilling. I'm one of the plaintiffs against the U.S. government in that case because you start detaining people without due process just because you define them as somehow being hostile to national security interests. I mean, in the 80s, that means most of us would have gone to jail who were in solidarity with Nelson Mandela. He was on the terrorist list for 20-some years in solidarity with the struggle against America, South African apartheid, you know. So that you're right. These are dangerous times, but we just have to be courageous. We have to take a stand, straighten our backs up.
Dr. Cornel West is author with Tavis Smiley of the new book, The Rich and the Rest of Us, A Poverty Manifesto. And they will be speaking at the Paramount in Oakland this Saturday at 6 o'clock. KALW is putting on this event, and we wanted it to be as diverse as possible. So it's a free ticket, and we're hoping to have a number of, we are going to have a number of community organizations there. And if you'd like to sign up, the tickets are selling out fast. We should say we're giving them out fast. You can sign up at kalw.org, and we hope to see as many of you there as possible. And if you'd like to join us, the toll-free number is 866-798-8255, 866-798-8255. You can also leave a comment at yourcallradio.org. And let's hear from Anna in Oakland. Hi, Anna.
Hi. I wanted to make a suggestion for the lady who called in for her friend who couldn't get her prescription.
Yes.
And that is to check out some pharmacies outside of the U.S. I use one from, it's a Canadian pharmacy, and I think the main processing center is in India, and it's significantly cheaper. I mean, it still may be too much for this lady, but it has helped me a lot. And also, you can get your pills in bulk. So if you have a really high copay, then it might turn out to be cheaper just to get a bunch in bulk and not use your insurance if you have it every month.
Well, thank you so much. I appreciate the suggestion. And Dr. West, we had a caller earlier, Joanne, who said that her friend, who's worked her entire life, is having a really hard time paying for her prescription because she doesn't apply, or she doesn't qualify, I should say. And I'm thinking we should just do a sort of how to navigate the system 101 show. Because so many people just cannot meet their basic needs.
Absolutely. I mean, this is part of, I'm so good that you render that kind of service, to have one fellow citizen informing another in order to stay afloat. That's a beautiful thing. But again, you can see the degree to which, my God, right across the border, you know, no Canadian would ever even make a call because they're all taken care of. You know what I mean?
Yeah, exactly. And Ed actually called in with some advice. He suggests applying for Section 8 housing. So I hope that really helps you, Joanne. And Anna, thank you for calling in. Let's go next to Greg in Palo Alto. Hi, Greg. Hello, Greg. All right, sorry about that. Let's go to email from Kate, who says, I agree that the income inequality needs to be addressed immediately in order to preserve our democracy. One thought I keep coming back to is that we need to address the tax structure. Up to the 80s, we had a tax structure that funded programs for the middle class and the poor and also helped to limit income inequality. He goes on to talk about, I'm sorry, Kate, she goes on to talk about the attacks by Grover Norquist. And Dr. West, last week on Tax Day, we did a whole conversation about the federal tax system. And I'm just curious, what are your thoughts on the fact that the Democrats are pushing this Buffett rule? I mean, President Obama is talking about this every day. What they don't talk about is this Buffett rule would only raise $5 billion a year.
That's right. That's right.
No, they still can't get it up for debate.
It's a drop in the bucket. I mean, it's just like the mortgage relief, $28 billion. It sounds like a lot, but we need $700 billion, so it's a drop in the bucket. But it's a kind of populist gesture of a neoliberal Democratic Party that's tied to oligarchs and tied to big business and big corporations. We've got both parties that are tied to big business. And there's no doubt, you know, the neoliberal version of oligarchic rule, the Democrats, are in some sense better than the Republicans, because Mitt Romney strikes me as being dangerous. But there's a certain danger even in the Democratic Party being so relatively milquetoast and spineless when it comes to really executing something on behalf of working people and on behalf of poor people. So we still have to make a relative choice in the election, of course. And again, you know, Obama certainly looks better in that sense. But the system itself that Obama heads is just so shot through with levels of injustice that when you talk about a Buffett bill, it's just a drop in the bucket. We need massive jobs creation programs. We need massive investment in education, not cutbacks in education. Massive investment in housing, not non-existent housing programs or cutbacks in housing programs. But see, all this talk about austerity and cutting, and Democrats have contributed to that in a serious way, right, makes the depression worse. It makes the recession worse.
I guess that's what makes this so frustrating, Dr. West, is we talk about these issues on this show on a regular basis, and we know the solutions.
Yes.
And yet you can't even get a debate on the Buffett rule.
I know. I mean, it's so, yeah. It's not just a matter of will, but the hemorrhaging that takes place. Oligarchs in the media, oligarchs in the economy. They make it difficult for there to be a robust public conversation about public interest.
So you've got sort of your feet in both of these worlds. You go on these tours, you meet people in poor communities, and yet you're a professor. You're engaged with the corporate media. You're engaged with, I'm sure, the 1% and politicians. What do you think it will take? Because you organize. The Occupy movements they're coming back as a force in the spring. So what do you think it'll take to really start to bring this wall down?
Well, and I'll be right there with the Occupy movement activists, too. But I think in so many ways, though, Sister Rose, this is the third moment in American history where we need the kind of fundamental change to keep Democratic Project afloat. After we so mistreated our indigenous peoples in such an ugly way, we know that America began with a revolt against monarchy, against the British king. And it took revolution. Unfortunately, it was violent and so on. The second moment was slavery, and we needed to break the back of white supremacist slavery. That was the second American Revolution. Unfortunately, even though the Union Army won the war, the white supremacy won the peace with Jim Crow and Jane Crow, so you had slavery by another name. So in the 1960s, we had another second moment of that revolution against slavery to break the back of Jim and Jane Crow. Right now, the issue is oligarchy. Oligarchy, plutocracy. It's squeezing the juices out of democracy. And it's linked to, of course, the global capitalist economy. And that transformation of oligarchy is going to be an inside affair and an outside affair. It's going to be a matter of trying to put pressure on politicians, especially progressive ones who have strong voices like Bernie Sanders and Keith Ellison and others. But it's also going to be outside. It's going to be social movements, which means many of us are going to end up in jail again. We're going to be in the streets again. We're going to put pressure again, and it's going to require a fundamental transformation. And, of course, as someone building on the legacy of Martin King and Rabbi Abraham Joshua Heschel and Sister Dorothy Day, it's got to be a peaceful and nonviolent fundamental transformation, but that's what it's going to take.
We're speaking with Dr. Cornel West, who with Tavis Smiley is out with a new book, The Rich and the Rest of Us, A Poverty Manifesto. And again, they will be speaking this Saturday at the Paramount Theater in Oakland at 6 o'clock. It's a free event presented by KALW, and you can get tickets at kalw.org. We've got about 10 minutes left, so if you'd like to weigh in on this conversation and talk about how poverty really affects our democracy, what should the response be to these attacks? What will it take to even get liberal and progressive groups to really talk about these issues? The toll-free number is 866-798-8255, 866-798-8255. You can also leave a comment, yourcallradio.org, or email feedback@yourcallradio.org. And I believe we have Greg in Palo Alto. Hey, Greg.
Hi, hello, thank you.
Sure, hi.
A number of things. One, first of all, this is class warfare. That's what the rich used to claim that the poor or other people who were criticizing them were engaging in, but this is what the rich have been engaging in against the poor for who knows how long. A couple of other things that you might want to keep in mind is that it discourages people from participation in the process and the poverty. I mean, when you're worried about trying to put food on the table or pay your rent or whatever, your ability to participate in the democratic process is diminished, and that's one way it affects the political process. The other thing you might want to keep in mind, and I don't know if you've done a program on this, in January of this year, there's going to be cuts coming, automatic cuts under this sequestration program, the Erskine Bowles and whatever that Obama appointed this committee. These cuts are going to be devastating in January, and I don't think people are really paying attention to that. And I'm hoping that maybe you might think about doing a program on that. Lastly, I think it'd be nice to I think it'd be helpful if there was some way for some program like yours to maybe on a periodic basis get politicians on in Sacramento or whatever, have a call-in show like this and try and find out why aren't these politicians doing anything to try and address this issue.
You know, it's Greg, I'm glad you brought this up. We often talk about whether it's worth it to bring on politicians on the show because they always spew these talking points. But, I mean, if we could push them against a wall and get them to actually talk about it, we would be happy to do it. It's just, I mean, look at the national dialogue. So, you know, Greg, maybe we'll try it and see. Dr.
Okay.
West, what are your thoughts on that?
Brother Greg just hit the nail on the head.
Yeah.
The war against the poor and working people intensified in the last 30 years. 1% of the population getting 83% income growth. Just years for last, 1% of the population got 93% of the income growth. 97% of you can remember, we got 7%. And the 99% wrestling with the 7% resources.
Well, and the other thing, Dr. West, this election will undoubtedly be about the middle class, as it was in 2008. And the Washington Post's Harold Meyerson had this really great piece about who's really recovering here. And, of course, it's the massive corporations. But what he pointed out that's not getting much attention is the middle class are being offered jobs that used to pay, say, $45 to $50 an hour with really good benefits. Now they're making 12, maybe 20 bucks an hour if they're lucky, with no benefits.
That's exactly right. 40% of the new jobs are low-income jobs, low-wage jobs. So you see the race to the bottom. Brother Harold's an old partner and friend of brother of mine, and he's absolutely right about that. But part of it has to do with what Greg was talking about. How do we reinforce the fight back, reinforce the awakening? The only way there's going to be change is when poor and working people become strong enough, awake enough, determined enough, and courageous enough to organize and to fight. That's going to be the precondition for any kind of transformation that we're talking about.
What about liberal groups and progressive groups? What role do you think they play here? Have they done enough to talk about these issues?
No. I think liberals, of course, have been sometimes part of the problem. There's some very wonderful liberals like Paul Krugman. He's a progressive liberal, but most of the neoliberals have been part of the problem. They're the ones who deregulated the markets in the 90s, the Summers and others, and the Geithners who Obama brought in to somehow deal with the crisis, even though they very, in some ways were very much responsible for the crisis. Progressive liberals certainly make a difference. My dear brother Robert Reich there at Berkeley, I think he calls himself a progressive liberal, that he's very concerned about precisely the kind of issues that I'm talking about. But we should keep in mind, you see, when you're talking about poverty, I mean, you've got some conservative brothers and sisters who are deeply concerned about poverty, even though the conservative elites tend to be mean-spirited toward poverty. You've got conservative evangelicals who are concerned about poverty, but oftentimes the conservative evangelical leaders are not. So that poverty is a kind of issue that has a moral and spiritual dimension that's not just reducible to politics and economics. But the kind of fundamental transformation that I'm talking about, there are moments in which liberals actually are impediments as opposed to springboards.
And Dr. West, Robert just writes in and says, Dr. West, please stop promoting the division of the poor through identity politics and educate people better about the class war. He says we need a real revolution, not more support for the least worst of limited choices. The Buffett rule is a joke. We do not need tax equality. We need the rich to pay more.
Well, I think I'd have to ask the brother what he means by identity politics. If he wants me to stop talking about the new Jim Crow because black and brown people are disproportionately there, then he's not going to get it. If he's talking about people coming together, black, white, red, yellow, and brown, then he's got it. I'm with him 100%. But we cannot act as if racism doesn't exist or sexism doesn't exist or homophobia do not exist. We talk about those honestly, and then we come together and unify. So that I reject the accusation, but I look forward to the working with the person dealing with the class unity that we want, human unity that we want.
All right. Thank you, Robert. Celine from Capitola says, thank you, Dr. West, for helping me remember to love more than rage. His love of mankind is a model for us all.
Well, I aspire to it. I fall on my face. I aspire to it. But again, of course, see, as a Christian, and I know that sometimes it's very unsettling with my secular brothers and sisters, but that's fundamentally what I try to do is to love everybody, beginning with the love of weak, vulnerable, orphan, widow, working people, and do it in such a way that it reinforces their humanity, the distinctive dignity of each and every person. And in a capitalist economy and a racist and sexist and homophobic one, too much anti-Semitism, too much anti-Arab and anti-Muslim racism, too much losing contact with humanity, the physically challenged. These are all concerns that have to do with morality and spirituality for me.
And Dr. West, and thanks for the email, Celine. Before we get to our next caller, on this tour that you're taking, do you come in contact with conservatives or poor people who call themselves Tea Partiers, who claim they want tax cuts and no benefits, even though they might be on Medicare and you know, are looking forward to their Social Security?
Oh, very much so.
And what do those conversations sound like?
Well, we try to tease out the contradictions, and they try to tease out the contradictions in us, that they are highly suspicious of government when it comes to helping other folk, but they want government to help them. They're very much tied to Social Security, but they believe the poor people, other poor people different than themselves, are dependent on welfare. And we try to say, look, you know, investment bankers have been dependent on welfare when they get in trouble with bailouts, that you are, in fact, dependent on Social Security. Why? Because you do deserve it. You work very hard. You sacrifice and so on. And there are poor children and many other persons who do need the food stamps, who do need various kinds of support and social network for the social safety nets, and that you try to broaden their perspective and see how inconsistent they are. And a lot of times it has to do with just a certain kind of indifference, if not contempt, for people who just don't look like them. That's part of the struggle that we have to deal with.
Well, we have time for one more caller. Let's go to Sir Cavedo, who I believe is calling in from Youth Radio in Oakland. Hi, Sir Cavedo. Welcome to the show.
Oh, hi. Thanks for having me. So I guess my question is, I said, I work at Youth Radio, and I've been covering issues of employment access for young people. So I guess my question is, as poverty increases and college becomes increasingly unobtainable, where do young people go next? How do we get to a position to make changes when we can't even find entry-level positions or afford education?
Well, I think, on the one hand, I appreciate the question. As you know, I mean, good God, student organizations have been quite magnificent in terms of putting pressure on state legislatures. Why is it that student debt now exceeds the credit card debt? Can more effective forms of student organizing, connected to trade union organizing, connected to organizing in other communities around different kind of issues, present us the kind of challenge to a status quo where the priorities that are now warped, that would give more money to jails and education, can be changed? In the meantime, it's going to be a question of trying to somehow be part of networks and organizations that can both allow you to sustain yourself economically even as you engage politically.
All right. Well, thank you for calling, Sir Cavedo. We hope to see members of Youth Radio at our event on Saturday. And Dr. West, in our remaining 30 or so seconds, organize. What do you think at this point is most effective as the Occupy movement prepares for spring and summer?
Well, it's a good question, though. It depends on which particular issue. I think that we definitely saw that when you put your bodies on the line that you can shift public discourse. Now the question is going to be, can we generate some strategies and tactics? I do believe that when you begin to engage in effective strikes, for example, I know Oakland made a gallant attempt to shut down ports and so forth, you do galvanize not just energy, but you shift the discourse. We need to shift the discourse, shift the climate of opinion. We need to use all the forms of nonviolent resistance, all the forms of civil disobedience, all the forms of not just getting attention to the issue, but trying to get significant concessions from the powers that be. And it's going to be different from one city to the next, given the strength and balance of forces, but it has to be a full-fledged movement, very much like what we saw in the 1960s. And again, coming out of King's legacy, you got to keep the love in it, though. I don't like revenge. I don't like bigotry. I don't like racism or sexism or any kind of ugly ideology to lose sight of humanity of people.
Well, we'll change the dialogue on Saturday. We'll see you then, Dr. West.
But thank you so much, KALW, your call, Sister Rose.
All right.
Thank you so much.
Thank you so much, Dr. West. And again, Dr. West and Tavis Smile will be appearing at the Paramount 6 o'clock on Saturday. It's a free event. Register at KALW.org. Thank you for listening. Here's what's coming up tomorrow. are city workers organizing to get contracts with living wages and health care? On the next Shore Call, we'll have a conversation about city workers' issues. Last week, over 1,000 San Francisco workers took to the streets to raise awareness about negotiations that include wage cuts and higher health care premiums. How are workers negotiating fair benefits? Join us at 10 or email feedback@yourcallradio.org. If you're a city employee, how are budget cuts affecting you? It's Shore Call with me, Rose Aguilar, and you.